From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're celebrating 50 years of Samuel Beckett's epic play, Waiting for Godot.
Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Godot.
Ah. You're sure it was here?
What?
That we were to wait.
He said by the tree. Do you see any others?
What is it?
I don't know. A willow.
Where are the leaves?
It must be dead.
No more weeping.
Perhaps it's not the season.
Looks to me more like a bush.
A shrub.
A bush.
What are you insinuating? That we've come to the wrong place?
He should be here.
He didn't say for sure he'd come.
And if he doesn't come?
We'll come back tomorrow.
And then the day after tomorrow.
Possibly.
And so on.
The point is...
Until he comes.
You're merciless.
We came here yesterday.
Ah, no, there you're mistaken.
What did we do yesterday?
What did we do yesterday?
Yes.
Why... Nothing is certain when you're about!
In my opinion, we were here.
You recognize the place.
I didn't say that.
Well...
That makes no difference.
All the same, that tree, that bog...
You're sure it was this evening?
What?
That we were to wait.
He said Saturday. I think.
You think?
I must have made a note of it.
But what Saturday? And is it Saturday? Is it rather not Sunday? Or Monday. Or Friday.
It's not possible.
Or Thursday.
What'll we do?
If he came yesterday and we weren't here, you may be sure he won't come again today.
But you say we were here yesterday.
I may be mistaken. Let's stop talking for a minute. Do you mind?
50 years ago, this Sunday, Samuel Beckett's masterpiece, Waiting for Godot, premiered at the Babylon Theater in Paris. The play where nothing happens, where two tramps wait for someone they don't know, don't even know when or if he'll come, on a stage with almost no scenery or props, enjoyed instant success as one of the most confounding and compelling theatrical works ever written. Waiting for Godot put existentialism on stage, staring at the search for hope in the face of despair, of nothingness, at the heart of the human condition. After seeing Godot, the American writer William Saroyan said, "It will make it easier for me and everyone else to write freely in theater." Over the last 50 years, Waiting for Godot has been performed on the four corners of the earth, on Broadway, in summer stock, and even in San Quentin Penitentiary. Tonight, we're wrestling with the existential heart of Samuel Beckett's masterpiece and its continuing grip on us today. We are joined in the studio tonight by members of the new Repertory Theater in Newton, Massachusetts, who will be performing scenes from Waiting for Godot throughout the hour. Playing Vladimir is Austin Pendleton, playing Estragon is John Kuntz, and playing Pazzo is Ken Balton. We're also joined this hour in New York City, or from New York City, by Lois Oppenheim, chair of the French, German, and Russian Department at Montclair State University in Montclair, New Jersey, and author of The Painted Word, Samuel Beckett's Dialogue with Art, and editor of Directing Beckett. And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, we're joined by Enoch Brader, a professor of English and theater at the University of Michigan and author of The Essential Samuel Beckett. Welcome, Lois Oppenheim and Enoch Brader.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you for being there and to all three of our wonderful actors for being in the studio tonight. It's a cast of thousands tonight on Point. And we're taking on Waiting for Godot. It's unusual territory for us. It's a play that everybody knows the name of, that everyone's worked into a joke at one time or another in their life. Many have seen it sometime or read it sometime in school. For many of those, it hasn't been for years, and many others have never seen or read it, only know it as a kind of cultural icon, a kind of challenge from the theater world. Enoch Brader, if you'd be good enough, just put in a nutshell, paint a word picture of Waiting for Godot for us. We're going to hear some great excerpts tonight, but give us kind of the sweep of this play.
Well, that's a rather easy assignment because it has a very simple plot line and a very simple rising action. It's a play, as you said just moments ago, where we watch two men on stage alone. All the stage set has is a tree and a rock and a horizon that seems to go on forever. They wait for Godot. That's their assignment. And he doesn't come in the first act. They get some reinforcements from two additional characters, Pazzo and Lucky. At the end of that act, a young boy, unidentified, comes and says that Godot won't come today, but perhaps he'll come tomorrow. And the second act is a variation on the first, somewhat shorter, in which the only scenic change is that the bare tree has sprouted a few leaves. Pazzo and Lucky return in diminished state. Pazzo is now blind, and Lucky is now dumb. Beckett said perhaps he was called lucky because he had no expectations. Mm. And at the end of his scene ends just the way the first act concluded, with the boy saying that Godot will not appear. And we're left alone on the stage with this moment in which Gogo and Didi, that's Vladimir and Estragon, rather than leave, say they're going to leave and have my most favorite stage direction in all of Western theater. They say, let's go, and the stage directions are, they do not move. That's
they,
it.
They do not move, and that's it. And we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. Lois Oppenheim, talk to us in drama terms and in philosophical terms about what made this such an earthquake and what makes it a challenging play even today.
Well, first let me say that this is, as you said, Tom, an intensely philosophical play. It reflects the post-war atmosphere of Paris. Loss and alienation were the watchwords of the day in Paris, and I think it's a play that reflects the senselessness of not only our having lived through one world war, but a second world war, the absurdity, not in the sense of ridiculousness, but absurdity with a capital A, meaning the non-meaning of it all, and the difficulties of communication. This was a time when religious and philosophical systems and established meanings and certainty of meaning was rejected, and Beckett was peripherally associated with what became known as the French Nouveau Roman, the New Novel, a group of novelists who went out on a philosophical and aesthetic limb, so to speak, and were all published by the Édition de Minuit.
So this is Camus and Sartre?
No, actually, this is Michel Butor, Alain Robbe-Grillet, Robert Pinget, Claude Simon.
Okay, you're beyond my pay grade there, but I'll trust
but
that.
A group of substantial size, and this grew out of the philosophical concerns of Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and others.
Lois, what was it that Samuel Beckett was putting in the face of the audience that they had not been confronted with in the theater before when they sat down to watch Waiting for Godot?
I think what we were forced to face was that we don't know why we're here, what we're doing here, what the purpose of it is, of life is, and nonetheless, we're obliged to go on. I think that it's important to remember that Camus had published The Myth of Sisyphus in 1942, and this, I think Beckett's work strongly reflects the existential position of Camus in that work. How do we go on in a world where we don't know why we're here or what we're doing here, and we have no reason to hope for anything better and no reason to believe that there's any superior being who's organized it all for us?
So this was a sort of God is dead moment. It's nothing but us sitting by a roadside with a scraggly old tree, and is this all there is?
This is a metaphor for life. This play is a metaphor for the human condition. We are sitting by a roadside, yes. What are we doing there? We're waiting. We're all faced with the same complexity and unknowingness, lack of knowledge about what it is we're meant to be doing here.
When this hit the stage in 1953 in Paris, was this a revolutionary notion, or was this the flowering on stage of something people had been reading about, something that had been in intellectual circles for a while already?
I think it was a play that certainly reflected the intellectual atmosphere of the time, but I don't think it had any real precedent. Well, Ina can answer this better than I can, but I think it was very, very revolutionary in terms of the theatrical.
I mean, visually, it is quite stunning. I mean, imagine you go to the theater and the curtain goes up and you see so little. I mean, you make the whole notion of nothingness palpable and real in theatrical terms. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the notion of nothingness philosophically. It's quite another to try to render that in very practical theatrical language in terms of scenography, in terms of costume, in terms of stage set, design, lighting, etc. And that kind of minimalist aesthetic, which we now take for granted in the theater, was really quite startling when we first saw it in Paris in 1953.
When that curtain first came up, let's hear some more from Waiting for Godot. Here's a scene from Act One again, in this case Austin Pendleton as Vladimir, John Kuntz as Estragon. And imagine that empty stage, just the scraggly tree, and Waiting for Godot.
What do we do now?
Wait.
Yes, but while waiting.
What about hanging ourselves?
It'd give us an erection.
An erection?
With all that follows, where it falls, mandrakes grow. That's why they shriek when you pull them up. Did you not know that?
Let's hang ourselves immediately.
From above, I wouldn't trust it.
We can always try.
Go ahead.
After you.
No, no, you first.
Why me?
You're lighter than I am.
Just so.
I don't understand.
Use your intelligence, can't you?
I remain in the dark.
This is how it is. The bow. The bow. Use your head, can't you?
You're my only hope.
Go, go, light. Bow not break. Go, go, dead. Dee Dee,
heavy.
Bow break. Dee Dee, alone. Whereas...
I hadn't thought of that.
If it hangs you, it'll hang anything.
But am I heavier than you?
So you tell me. I don't know. There's an even chance, or nearly.
Well, what do we do?
Don't let's do anything. It's safer.
Let's wait and see what he says.
Who?
Godot.
Good idea.
Let's wait till we know exactly how we stand.
And there they are, standing, sitting, waiting. Enoch Breder, take us into this. Here are Vladimir and Estragon. Who are these two characters? Do they emerge as distinctive faces of the human character? And what are they wrestling with here as they try and decide, as they wait, whether or not to hang themselves?
Well, one of the things that's, I think, very important for us all to understand about this kind of dramatic situation is that, first of all, it is extremely human, and part of that humanity of that is that how hilarious it is, because there's a great deal of humor along the way. While it, on a philosophical level, we might say that nothing happens. I mean, nothing is a wide repertory of nothing. These characters do a lot of things. I mean, they laugh, they talk, they tell jokes, they play games, they eat. They do all sorts of strange things. So
Ina,
the idea...
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Lois Oppenheim.
It might be interesting to talk a little bit about what the origin of that humor is. The Charlie Chaplin kind of gags and the vaudeville and all of that.
We heard a kind of who's on first dynamic right there in that exchange.
Right. Well, one of the things that made, I think, that made the play very popular at the time was, in fact, that there was an incorporation of all sorts of cabaret bits and banter, and as Lois was just saying, a lot of this Charlie Chaplin business, the bowler hats and all that sort of thing, so that we shouldn't come away from the play thinking that this is, you know, heavy, heavy existential kind of drama. That is true metaphorically, but in terms of the practical level of the theater, there's an incredible allusions to all sorts of humor and bits that people had seen in silent movies. Beckett himself was a great fan of silent movies of Charlie Chaplin, and later, of course, did an important work with Buster Keaton.
So Samuel Beckett wasn't saying life is humorless, just he wasn't sure what was at the middle of it. Austin Pendleton, you've played this and played it definitively for many years. You were in a famous production, I think, in the early 70s that was directed by one of Beckett's assistants?
Yes, in 1978, actually, directed by Walter Asmus.
When you stand up to play this, what's the emotional end of the spectrum that you find yourself in, or is it right across the palette of emotions?
Across the palette, but let me explain. The other two times I've been in this play,
yes,
which included that production you just referred to, I played Estragon, and now I'm playing Vladimir.
Yeah.
It's like being in a different play to play those two parts.
Because?
The content of the play actually seems different. I mean, I would imagine would be true with any play if you played two different roles in it, but quite radically, it just seems like what everything means comes into you differently.
Because Vladimir's the thinker here, Vladimir's the conscience here.
Yeah, and Vladimir is therefore privy or to seeing things in a way that's kind of frightening. Estragon is interested in carrots, you know, and
his feet.
Right.
And
who's heavier?
Yeah, and it's fine if you hang yourself because in the process you'll get an erection.
Yeah, woo-hoo,
you know,
let's
you
do know. It. It'll kill time.
I mean, Estragon is in a way more pessimistic and more full of despair even than Vladimir.
He's the blithe spirit.
But in the moment-to-moment level, he's much more.
We are looking tonight at Waiting for Godot. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are looking and listening tonight to Samuel Beckett's masterpiece of theater, Waiting for Godot.
One of the thieves was saved. It's a reasonable percentage. Oh, go.
What?
Suppose we repented.
Repented what?
Oh. We wouldn't have to go into the details.
Our being born?
Oh, one daren't even laugh anymore.
Dreadful privation.
Merely smile. It's not the same thing. Yeah. Nothing to be done. Go, go.
What?
Did you ever read the Bible?
The Bible?
Mm-hmm.
I must have taken a look at it.
You remember the Gospels?
I remember the maps of the Holy Lands. Oh, colored they were. Very pretty. The Dead Sea was a pale blue. The very look of it made me thirsty. That's where we'll go, I used to say. That's where we'll go for our honeymoon. We'll swim. We'll be happy.
You should have been a poet.
I was. Isn't that obvious?
Where was I? How's your foot?
Swelling visibly.
Ah, yes, the two thieves. Do you remember the story?
No.
Shall I tell it to you?
No.
It'll pass the time. Two thieves crucified at the same time as our Savior. One.
Our what?
Our Savior. Two thieves. One is supposed to have been saved, and the other... Damn.
Saved from what?
Hell.
I'm going.
And yet, how is it? This is not boring you, I hope. How is it that of the four evangelists, only one speaks of a thief being saved? The four of them were there or thereabouts, and only one speaks of a thief being saved. Come on, Gogo, return the ball. Can't you once in a way?
I find this really most extraordinarily interesting.
One out of four. Of the other three, two don't mention any thieves at all, and the third says that both of them abused him.
Who?
What?
What's this all about? Abused who?
The Savior.
Why?
Because he wouldn't save them.
From hell?
Imbecile, from death.
I thought you said from hell.
From death! From death!
Well, what of it?
Then the two of them must have been damned.
And why not?
But one of the four says that one of the two was saved.
Well, they don't agree, and that's all there is to it.
But all four were there, and only one speaks of a thief being saved. Why believe him rather than the other?
Who believes him?
Everybody, it is the only version they know.
People are bloody ignorant apes.
But they are apes that wrestle with the meaning of life even when they can't find it. Looking, I guess, here at Los Oppenheim at religion, or at least there's plenty of religious language and imagery brought up in this passage. We're talking about repentance, we're talking about a savior, and people as bloody, ignorant apes. What's the message?
Well, I think there are a lot of biblical allusions in the play, but I don't think that we should overly stress them. It's not a play about God. It's not a play about religion. It's a play about how do we know what we think we know. It's an epistemological issue, and it's a play about identity. It's a play about how do we know this is Saturday as opposed to Sunday as opposed to Wednesday. How does the boy know he saw us, the boy that comes toward the end of Act mm-hmm. 1 and the end of Act 2?
That Godot won't
yes,
be coming.
Yes, mm. And I think the biblical allusions are strong, but I don't think that it's necessary to overemphasize them and to find all the biblical sources to understand what's going on. Yes, Estragon compares himself to Christ. There is the story of the two thieves. It certainly adds more than a touch of cynicism to the whole play. It keeps the focus
savior,
on
what
suffering.
Savior.
Right, exactly. And there's no one to save us, failed hope, but it's not a play about religion.
Right. I think it's also, you see, in that passage that the actors just did so well, and that's really Beckett in a nutshell, because you have, at this one hand, very, very serious issues about religion and God and repentance. And on the other hand, it's sort of a hilarious kind of
yes, it is again,
thing. And it's not
burlesque.
That alternately. I think it's important to understand that it's both of those impulses simultaneously, which adds a lot of irony and richness and edge to the whole piece. Something that is, on the one hand, philosophically very challenging in terms of religious belief is also hilarious at the same time. And that's a kind of very Beckettian feel that you get out of Godot, which makes the play very appealing. Beckett himself said that if he had meant God, he would have said God. This is Godot, which is at the best a little God.
Right.
And he once told that to Ralph Richardson, the actor who was thinking about being in this play, and that seemed to have disturbed Richardson very much.
And yet, Enoch Breder, audiences and readers have always read God into this play. Would that have infuriated Beckett? Is that inevitable? Would he say that that means we are still under the illusions he was trying to crack open?
Well, Beckett, it's been asked, you know, he did comment on that, and he said, you know, Christianity is a system of believe it, which I am perfectly familiar, so naturally I use it. But he wouldn't give it any special value over anything else. In fact, if we could say that the play was a kind of a reification of this Christian myth, then in a sense, philosophically, Godot would have come. The whole idea is that, yes, we don't know. And that's one of the many important resonances in the play. It's many of the systems of belief that I think Beckett is short-circuiting in the context of the play. The truth in this play is that we really don't know the answers. It's not that they're true or false. It's just that we just don't know.
Enoch Prater, who was Samuel Beckett, and where was he in his life, in his career, when he wrote Waiting for Godot?
Well, he wrote this very important part. As most people know, Beckett, of course, is one of the great Irish writers, and he follows in this sort of tradition of Yeats and Shaw, mm-hmm, and, of course, James Joyce. He was born in 1906 and came to study first at Trinity College, Dublin, mm-hmm, then on to a period in Paris, then back to Ireland, then London, finally settling in Paris in the 1930s. Beckett struggled to be a writer, and I always had a soft spot in my heart for Beckett because he's one of these great late bloomers, very Irish in that regard.
And said he was a sad boy, a sad youth, a sad man.
Right, but very serious, a very good student, and a very good player of cricket, which was a great passion all of his life. And when he lived in Paris, he could stay there after the invasion of the Nazis because he was a citizen of neutral Ireland.
He had been in World War I. He stayed in occupied France during World War II.
Right. He hadn't been in World War. He was still a boy during the First World War, but he was able to stay in Paris after the invasion of the Nazi hordes because of his citizenship. But, of course, during that period, he worked from the underground and was a translator of documents that had been captured from the German fronts. And then they were then flown to Allied headquarters in London. After the war, during the war, he had to stay in the south of France in Roussillon.
He ultimately fled from occupied France, I guess.
Right, with his wife, Suzanne. And they went south because she had relatives there. And then after the armistice, he went back to Dublin briefly to see his family, then came back to work for the Irish Red Cross, and eventually came back to his apartment in Paris, which had been mercifully intact. It was during that period that these are the great years of Beckett's writing. He wrote the important novels, Malone Dies, which you know in English is Malloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable. And it was between this period of Malone Dies and The Unnameable that he started writing two plays, one called Eleuterio, which is a very big monster play, and then, of course, this play Anatole Godot, which we know in English is Waiting for Godot. He wrote it in French in a school notebook, and the manuscripts exist at the University of Reading in London, where there's a great Beckett archive. And if you look at that, you can see that he wrote this very quickly indeed. So it's a play that comes out of this post-war period and out of this moment when Beckett is feeling very frustrated by the writing of the novels. He said that he had to write for a habitable space, and he found it on the stage. That is really where that play comes from, written in the late 40s, not performed until 1953, because no one would take up the play.
But very much a play coming out of the World War II era,
exactly,
and the philosophy, right, and kind of attitudes that emerged after,
right,
the war.
And it's important to note that there's nothing in the play, although it's we can date it philosophically to that historical period, mm-hmm, it's a play that has a very timeless, endless kind of atmosphere. It doesn't allude to much in particular.
But it has a lot to do with time. Enoch Prater, stand by, and Lois Oppenheim. Let's hear a little more. Hear from Act Two in Waiting for Godot. We call it the tree scene, but a scene where, again, Estragon and Vladimir, played by Austin Pendleton and John Kuntz, deal with time.
I was saying that things have changed here since yesterday.
Everything oozes.
Look at the tree.
It's never the same pus from one second to the next.
The tree? Look at the tree.
Was it not there yesterday?
Yes, of course it was there. Do you not remember? We nearly hanged ourselves from it, but you wouldn't. Do you not remember?
You dreamt it.
Is it possible you've forgotten already?
That's the way I am. Either I forget immediately or I never forget.
And Pozzo and Lucky, have you forgotten them too?
Pozzo and Lucky?
He's forgotten everything.
I remember a lunatic who kicked the shins off me, then he played the fool.
That was Lucky.
I remember that. But when was it?
And his keeper. Do you not remember him?
He gave me a bone.
That was Pozzo.
And all this was yesterday, you say?
Yes, of course it was yesterday.
And here, where we are now.
Where else do you think? Do you not recognize the place?
Recognize? What is there to recognize? All my lousy life I've crawled about in the mud, and you talk to me about scenery? Look at this muck heap. I've never stirred from it.
Calm yourself. Calm yourself.
You and your landscapes. Tell me about the worms.
All the same, you can't tell me that this... bears any resemblance to... to the Mackin country, for example. You can't deny there's a big difference.
The Mackin country? Who's talking to you about the Mackin country?
But you were there yourself in the Mackin country.
No, I was never in the Mackin country. I puked my puke of a life away here. Here, I tell you. Here in the Kackin country.
But we were there together, I could swear it, picking grapes for a man called... can't think of the name of the man, at a place called... can't think of the name of the place. Do you not remember?
It's possible. I didn't notice anything.
But down there, everything is red!
I didn't notice anything, I tell you!
You're a hard man to get on with, Gogo.
And we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting for Godot. Lois Oppenheim, here, I guess, an example of how Samuel Beckett in the play shows humans filling time with a kind of ignorant back and forth about what they don't remember, what they do, what they can't remember from yesterday.
Well, it's actually interesting to note that the original title was not Waiting for Godot. The original title was Waiting, En Attendant, without the word Godot. The emphasis really is on the waiting. Time is subjectively perceived, and that's what Beckett wants to make us aware of. It's subjectively perceived as passing more or less rapidly. And the point is that time passes anyway, no matter how we perceive it. There's a line, actually, where Vladimir says, that passed the time, and Estragon replies, it would have passed in any case. Time
not
just
so fast.
Not so fast, but it does go, nonetheless.
And so here again, he's putting the spotlight on all the ways in which we are not moored, or which there's not meaning, and perhaps the ways in which we fill up the time of our lives with exchanges, meaningful or otherwise.
Absolutely. I think Enoch made a good point before when he said that nothing is localized. It's not only that nothing is spatially localized in this play, but temporally localized. It could take place anywhere and in any era, and the universality of the play is part of its great appeal.
Yeah, and that's why I think the play has been, you know, performed all over the world, because there's nothing about this play which comes out of France after the in the post-war period that doesn't apply equally well to China or Japan or South Africa or Argentina. I mean, this could be any place. Any this kind of condition that Beckett is displaying is although it can be referenced historically to the late 40s in Paris, really seems to have a note in it which is widely applicable.
It certainly appeals to a large variety of people as well, not only people in different locations, but different people in different walks of life. There was the San Quentin production.
This is a famous production, 1957 in San Quentin prison in
right.
San Francisco.
Right.
And the response of the prisoners?
Was extraordinary. They recognized themselves there. They, too, were waiting. Then when you teach it in a college class, my students, you know, they identify with it immediately, as was pointed out in an essay by critic Linda Benz-Vee in a book that Enoch edited, co-edited,
yeah.
On Waiting for Godot. College students are waiting for the end of the semester. They're waiting for the end of the class. They're waiting for the end of college. They're waiting. They're waiting. I have actually incorporated in many of my courses a suggestion made by Linda Benz-Vee in that article. I walk into class when I'm going to teach Waiting for Godot, and I don't do anything. I just stand in front of the class, and I wait. And it's fascinating to observe the students' reaction to that waiting.
And, of course, prisoners would understand that very well in a setting where every day is very much like the day before and like the day that will come, and we're waiting is what it's all about.
But I think that's the very essence of why the play is not necessarily a play about negativity, although it is about nothingness. I think those are very different things, because it does point out to the audience, and the audience gets this in the gut, that all we have is the time as it's passing. I mean, we don't know where point A is, or well, that might be the origin of our life. Mm. We don't know. We know that B is waiting for us, but we don't know quite when that's going to happen. And all that we can be sure of is everything that exists in between. And that is what is in our hands. And in that sense, it seems to me that the play is not a play about negativity. It's a play about life, about the, making us recognize that what we have and what we only have and what we need to value is that moment as it is passing.
Even when it's a repetitive moment, let's hear just a little more of that from Austin Pendleton and John Kuntz here. And here, I guess also with Ken Bolton playing Pozzo, we call it the adieu scene from Act One. Let's hear.
Which of you smells so bad?
He has stinking breath, and I have stinking feet.
I must go.
And you're half hunter?
I must have left it at the manor.
Then adieu.
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 And thank you.
Thank you.
Not at all.
Yes, yes.
No, no.
Yes, yes.
No, no.
I don't seem to be able to depart.
Such is life.
You're going the wrong way.
Austin Pendleton, when you...
Yeah.
When you immerse yourself in this play, Enoch and Lois point out that, the message here is in part that there's a difference between nothingness and negativity.
Right.
There's repetition. It can be banal. There's lots of nothingness.
Well, these characters are very resourceful. I mean, it's what you do with nothingness, and they do a lot with it. Do you know what I mean? So that keeps it from being a play of negativity. I agree totally with what.
And so when you're immersed in it, as you've been immersed in many plays, but when you're immersed in Waiting for Godot, is it an upper or a downer?
Upper.
Even with all the repetition and all the... There is no meaning. There's just what we have right here, right now, even when it's stupid and talking about dog's vomit.
What's stupid about dog's vomit?
Oh, all right. What was I thinking?
Right. No, it's very alive, the play, you know? It's like the joy. There's a weird sort of joy in the play, and there's certainly a lot of hope.
That joy in the moment, that kind of zen of being there, no matter what it is, making it up, going on.
They don't ever say, "Look, we're going to give up."
They don't hang themselves.
You know, no. Even though they might get an erection on the way, even then they don't hang themselves, and they all have each other, you know. I was in when I was in the production that Walter Asmus directed, which was a kind of a
Beckett's assistant, the one in New York.
Beckett's representative on Earth, I called him.
Okay.
He came over from Germany. He'd been the assistant to Beckett when Beckett directed the German production in Beckett's own German translation, and Walter reproduced this production gesture by gesture and line reading by line reading, which is hard enough to be given line readings, but to be given line readings that are based on the German translation is particularly difficult when you're thinking in English. But the year before, I'd been in Three Sisters. Which has the same plot that this play has.
The waiting.
And even the same arguments between Tuzenbach and Vershinin are the same ones between Estragon and Vladimir. It would be interesting to do the two plays in rep with each other.
The pure joy.
Yeah.
We've got to take another break. We're talking tonight about Waiting for Godot. We are waiting. We are waiting. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about Samuel Beckett's great masterpiece, Waiting for Godot.
Don't go yet.
I'm going.
What do you do when you fall far from help?
We wait till we can get up. Then we go on. On!
Before you go, tell him to sing.
Who?
Lucky.
To sing?
Yes, or to think, or to recite.
But he's dumb.
Dumb.
Dumb. He can't even groan.
Dumb. Since when?
Have you not done tormenting me with your accursed time? It's abominable. When? When? One day. Is that not enough for you? One day he went dumb. One day I went blind. One day we'll go deaf. One day we were born. One day we will die. The same day, the same second. Is that not enough for you? They give birth astride of a grave. The light gleams an instant. Then it's night once more. On!
Ken Bolton as Pazzo and Austin Pendleton as Vladimir in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Lois Oppenheim, this has the feeling of a kind of climactic moment here. There's dumbness. There's an infatuation with time when it doesn't even matter. Lots of challenging ideas in this play. We've all talked about how people still relate to it, but are these ideas as challenging to audiences in 2003 as they were in 1953? Have we over all these decades somehow absorbed Beckett's worldview? Is it now a more natural part of our perspective on life?
I think that it's a profoundly political play, and I think it speaks to us today certainly as much as it did when it was written, when it was first produced, perhaps in a sense, unfortunately so. It's a play about our inhuman treatment of each other, particularly the passage that was just acted. There's a moment when Vladimir says, "Was I sleeping while the others suffered? Am I sleeping now, tomorrow when I wake or think I do? What shall I say of today?" It's a play about what we need to do for the others out there. This was the play that Susan Sontag took to Sarajevo when they were waiting for Clinton. This is a play about freedom, not only during the Second World War and the occupation in France. This is a play about the issue of freedom everywhere and at every time, and it's particularly pertinent to us now.
And Enoch Breeder, at the visceral level of how it's received by audiences, are those politics evident to people? And I guess I'll put the same question to you. Is it as challenging for us today as it was in 53, or has it become kind of part of the air we breathe, this perspective, which was revolutionary then?
Alan Schneider, who was Beckett's American director, said that Godot is no longer just a play. It has become a state of mind. I think that's a wonderful summary of this whole problem, that this play, I think, speaks with amazing clarity to audiences today. I think it's one of the reasons why a play is so often produced, as it's happening right now in Massachusetts, that this is a play that an audience can relate to, because the issue of waiting for something to arrive that never comes is really, in a sense, our world.
Was it seen as an attack on institutions in 1953, that this was the era when God was pronounced dead or right around then? Was this seen as a kind of attack on the psychological order of Western culture, of human culture?
No, I think that's making sort of claims for the theater that are very nice to think about. I don't think it really works in exactly those terms. Mm-hmm. I think it's not political in the sense of being specifically political about a given institution or about a political system. It's about the tyranny of a whole variety of systems that are always with us all the time. And some of that are the tyranny of a psychological makeup. Some of that is the tyranny of a given political structure. I think there are a lot of ways in which the play can be valued. But I don't think it's specific attack against anything in particular, even on the whole notion of God itself as it has existed in the Western world. I mean, these are all possibilities in the play. I mean, none of those can be censured. It's one of the reasons why we go back to the play and get so much sustenance from it, because it never is going to dot the final I and cross the final T.
And Austin Pendleton, you played in Waiting for Godot 25 years ago. You're doing it again now, coming up in just a few days. Has the experience changed for you? Do you find your own perspective on the meaning of it, the emanation of it, different than a quarter century ago?
Well, as I say, it's hard to tell because I'm playing a different role. So that it's changing just because of that. But, you know, there's something timeless about this play. I mean, it's like King Lear, you know. The things that this play is about will always be true, and they will always be disturbing to people, and they'll always be challenging to people. And the great plays are the plays that somehow make that kind of connection with something that's always there, always been there, always will be there.
John Kuntz, you're a younger actor playing in here. I mean, this play was written before you were born, I'm assuming. Does it have an antique feeling to you? Does it feel like something from half a century ago, even though it's got this timelessness?
Absolutely not. I mean, I have to agree with Austin that it's to crawl inside this play as an actor really requires you to look at things that I think we all spend a lot of time trying to avoid thinking about, our own imminent demise and immortality and the existence of God. And for an actor, that's just such a challenging and also kind of scary mount to try and climb.
And the suffering, there's also suffering in there.
Yes. And we spend a lot of time, I think, trying to avoid it. It's when the language stops, really, in the play that I've noticed that when the waiting, which is really agony for all four of the characters, that's when it really comes into relief. Mm.
Lois Oppenheim, the audience is participating here in a way, in those long silences, in that waiting, in the kind of boredom that's pushed onto them by Beckett in Waiting for Godot.
Yes, I'd say that the audience co-creates this play because of all of that waiting. I think that that was Beckett's philosophy of art as well as his purpose in this play. I think another thing needs to be said about this play, that what makes it quite as appealing to such a broad spectrum of people and have such a universal appeal, that it's a very visual play.
Even though it's so spare.
It is so spare, but it is very, very visual. That tree that was created by Giacometti for that Paris performance is something that is very hard to forget, that the two characters, Vladimir and Estragon, on that road that goes nowhere, the words have a power to generate a visual image that is really extraordinary, and I think this is true of all of Beckett's plays.
Well, we will leave with that image and with that waiting that we are part of, that the play so brings to life. Lois Oppenheim, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Lois Oppenheim is chair of the French, German, and Russian Department at Montclair State University in Montclair, New Jersey. And Enoch Brader, thank you for coming on. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
Enoch Brader joined us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's professor of English and theater at the University of Michigan and author of The Essential Samuel Beckett. And a great thanks to the actors here in studio with me, Austin Pendleton, who plays Vladimir, John Kuntz in the role of Estragon, and Ken Balton as Pazzo. Thanks to all of you for bringing Waiting for Godot to life for us here tonight.
Thank you very much.
It's been great. A special thanks also to this hour to Rick Lombardo and Adam Zoller at the New Repertory Theater. If you're in the Boston area, the New Repertory Theater will be kicking off its 2003 season with Waiting for Godot, opening on January 8th. For more information, you can visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook, Waiting for Godot. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I believe this situation with North Korea will be resolved peacefully. As I said, it's a diplomatic issue, not a military issue, and we're working all fronts.
The president has not made a decision yet with respect to the use of military force or with respect to going back to the United Nations, but it's a situation, of course, we're monitoring closely, and of course, we're positioning ourselves and positioning our military forces for whatever might be required.
If these people who talk about the war thought that our great republic was in imminent danger, it would fall short of being unpatriotic if they did not support allowing everyone the opportunity to share in the sacrifice we have to make for war.
The task ahead is enormous. The expectations are high. The challenges are intimidating. But I know that with your support and cooperation, we shall turn all our problems into opportunities.
If the American people want a lifelong politician in the White House, that's not me. They'll have a group of people to choose from if that's what they want. If they want instead somebody who is closer to them, more connected to them, has spent his entire life fighting for them and comes from them, that is me.
You know, I understand the politics of economic stimulus. If some would like to turn this into class warfare, that's not how I think. I think about the overall economy, how best to help those folks who are looking for work.
And there's a week President Bush says North Korea is not another Iraq, and he sees a diplomatic solution to the standoff with Pyongyang. Colin Powell acknowledges that U.S. troops are massing in the Persian Gulf. Nearly 60,000 U.S. military personnel are already in the Gulf, and that number could double in the coming weeks. Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel of New York announces he will introduce legislation to bring back the draft in the event of war with Iraq. Mwai Kibaki wins Kenya's elections, ousting the corrupt Kenya African National Union Party, which had held power for nearly 40 years. North Carolina Senator John Edwards tosses his hat into the 2004 presidential ring, and President Bush gives a brief preview of next week's speech in which he will lay out his economic stimulus package. There we go, Jack, from the DMZ and Korea right into the American pocketbook.
Yes, and you know, the DMZ business, it's striking. The president seems to have fallen into the same trap as his father. George Bush Sr. made a speech at the 1988 Republican convention. He said, "Read my lips, no new taxes."
Sounded great.
it sounded great. And, you know, his speechwriters put it in against the advice of Dick Darman and Richard and Jim Baker. Please don't put that in. He put it in. And, of course, in 1990, he had to raise taxes. And that, every read my lips, came back to haunt him. It was policy by speechmaker.
So on the Korean front, then?
And on the Korean front, again, a speechmaker in last year's State of the Union, I believe, came up with the phrase Axis of Evil, in which he included three states, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, which had nothing to do with one another. He shortly thereafter was fired. But the phrase lived on, and clearly, not alone, but as part of a pattern, it exacerbated and deepened the paranoia of that crazed regime there and has contributed in no little part to the deterioration we've seen with the North moving rapidly to build nuclear weapons.
Well, that's it. We heard President Bush saying here it is a diplomatic, not a military issue. We know they'd like to see it and package it that way, but it is a nuclear bomb.
It really is. And, you know, the administration says it will not negotiate with North Korea. It's hard to see how it gets out of this without negotiating with North Korea. You know, its critics will say, well, that's appeasement if we agree to a non-aggression pact with them. But that's what diplomacy is. When you don't want to fight a war, it isn't worth it to anybody. This is sort of an unstable regime. You make the best deal you can. Let's hope the Bush administration is working toward that.
Let's hope so. The ground is certainly shifting, with South Korea stepping up today and saying it will jump into the middle of this, whether the U.S. likes that or not. That's an entirely new role, a new dynamic there. On the home front, we are going to hear a lot more about economic stimulus in this coming week.
We are. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the president, the centerpiece of the president's stimulus program is going to be a cut in the dividend, the taxes, double taxation of dividends. The Wall Street Journal says wealthier Americans will benefit the most from the change. And, you know, this fits into a pattern of the Bush administration. And the president has said many times, you know, that wealthy people pay most of the taxes, which is absolutely right. And I've been trying to figure out, you know, what's the basis for this notion that if you just simply reward the already rewarded, all of us will benefit. And I think I have found it. It was really the credo of the Federalist Party. And there's a new biography out of Alexander Hamilton. Reading that, you can see the Bush program is the Hamilton program.
How so?
Hamilton wanted to protect industry. Bush is doing that. He wanted to give subsidies to companies to get them going. He wanted to, you know, have bonuses to companies that did the right thing. He wanted to, and he said, you know, the aim of government is to bind the property class to it, to protect it. And this was the essentially succoring industry and binding the rich and property to government, especially through the creation of a national bank. Well, this brought a reaction, as you can imagine. The reaction's name was Andrew Jackson. I wonder if there's an Andrew Jackson out there someplace.
Well, I wonder. George Bush calls it economic stimulus. On the other hand, the Bushes have been around for a while, Jack. They may remember that Alexander Hamilton character.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan would make a good joke about that.
Yeah, he would. He would have. Well, all eyes and ears will be on that speech on Tuesday. We'll be looking at that next week. In the meantime, Jack, keep reading those history books and bring us the true root of all things.
I'll do it, Tom.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Listeners, have a great weekend as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR. We're funded by...